Chapter 53. In the Red Deeps, the family sitting room was a long room with a window at each end, one looking toward the croft, and along the ripple to the banks of the Floss, the other into the mill yard. Maggie was sitting with her work against the latter window, when she saw Mr. Wackham entering the yard, as usual, on his fine black horse, but not alone, as usual. Someone was with him, a figure in a cloak, on a handsome pony. Maggie had hardly time to feel that it was Philip come back, before they were in front of the window, and he was raising his hat to her, while his father, catching the movement by a side glance, looked sharply round at them both. Maggie hurried away from the window and carried her work upstairs, for Mr. Wackham sometimes came in and inspected the books, and Maggie felt that the meeting with Philip would be robbed of all pleasure in the presence of the two fathers. Someday, perhaps, she could see him when they could just shake hands, and she could tell him that she remembered his goodness to Tom, and the things he had said to her in the old days, though they could never be friends anymore. It was not at all agitating to Maggie to see Philip again. She retained her childish gratitude and pity toward him, and remembered his cleverness. And in the early weeks of her loneliness, he had continually recalled the image of him among the people who had been kind to her in life, often wishing as he had him for a brother and a teacher, as they had fancied it might have been, in their talk together. But that sort of wishing had been banished along with other dreams that savored of seeking her own will, and she thought, besides, that Philip might be altered by his life abroad. He might have become worldly, and really not care about her saying anything to him now. And yet his face was wonderfully little altered. It was only a larger, more manly copy of the pale, small-featured boy's face, with the gray eyes, and the boyish waving brown hair. There was the old deformity, to awaken the old pity. And after all her meditations, Maggie felt that she really should like to say a few words to him. He might still be melancholy, as he always used to be, and like her to look at him kindly. She wondered if he remembered how he used to like her eyes. With that thought, Maggie glanced toward the square-looking glass which was condemned to hang with its face toward the wall, and she half started from her seat to reach it down. But she checked herself and snatched up her work, trying to repress the rising wishes by forcing her memory to recall snatches of hymns, until she saw Philip and his father returning along the road, and she could go down again. It was far on in June now, and Maggie was inclined to lengthen the daily walk which was her one indulgence. But this day and the following she was so busy with work which must be finished, that she never went beyond the gate, and satisfied her need of the open air by sitting out of doors. One of her frequent walks, when she was not obliged to go to St. Ogg's, was to a spot that lay beyond what was called the hill, an insignificant rise of ground crowned by trees, lying along the side of the road which ran by the gates of Dorlcote Mill. Insignificant I call it, because in height it was hardly more than a bank. But there may come moments when nature makes a mere bank a means toward a fateful result. And that is why I ask you to imagine this high bank crowned with trees, making an uneven wall for some quarter of a mile along the left side of Dorlcote Mill, and the pleasant fields behind it, bounded by the murmuring ripple. Just where this line of bank sloped down again to the level, a byroad turned off and led to the other side of the rise, where it was broken into very capricious hollows and mounds by the working of an exhausted stone quarry, so long exhausted that both mounds and hollows were now clothed with brambles and trees, and here and there by a stretch of grass which a few sheep kept close nibbled. In her childish days Maggie held this place, called the Red Deeps, in very great awe, and needed all her confidence in Tom's bravery to reconcile her to an excursion thither, visions of robbers and fierce animals haunting every hollow. But now it had the charm for her which any broken ground, any mimic rock and ravine, have four thighs that rest habitually on the level, especially in summer, when she could sit on the grassy hollow under the shadow of a branching ash, stooping aslant from the steep above her, and listen to the hum of insects, like tiniest bells on the garment of silence, or see the sunlight piercing the distant boughs, as if to chase and drive home the truant heavenly blue of the wild hyacinths. In this June time, too, the dog roses were in their glory, and that was an additional reason why Maggie should direct her walk to the Red Deeps, rather than to any other spot. On the first day she was free to wander at her will, a pleasure she loved so well, that sometimes, in her ardors of renunciation, she thought she ought to deny herself the frequent indulgence in it. You may see her now, as she walks down the favorite turning, and enters the deeps by a narrow path through a group of Scotch firs, her tall figure and old lavender gown visible through an hereditary black silk shawl of some wide mesh net-like material. And now she is sure of being unseen, she takes off her bonnet, and ties it over her arm. One would certainly suppose her to be farther on in life than her 17th year, perhaps, because of the slow resigned sadness of the glance from which all search and unrest seem to have departed, perhaps because her broad-chested figure has the mold of early womanhood. Youth and health have withstood well the involuntary and voluntary hardships of her lot, and the nights in which she has lain on the hard floor for a penance have left no obvious trace. The eyes are liquid, the brown cheek is firm and round, the full lips are red. With her dark coloring and jet crown surmounting her tall figure, she seems to have a sort of kinship with the grand Scotch firs, at which she is looking up, as if she loved them well. Yet one has a sense of uneasiness in looking at her, a sense of opposing elements, of which a fierce collision is imminent. Surely there is a hushed expression, such as one often sees in older faces under borderless caps, out of keeping with the resistant youth, which one expects to flash out in a sudden, passionate glance that will dissipate all the quietude, like a damp fire leaping out again when all seemed safe. But Maggie herself was not uneasy at this moment. She was clamly enjoying the free air, while she looked up at the old fir trees, and thought that those broken ends of branches were the records of past storms, which had only made the red stems soar higher. But while her eyes were still turned upward, she became conscious of a moving shadow cast by the evening sun on the grassy path before her, and looked down with a startled gesture to see Philip Wackham, who first raised his hat, and then, blushing deeply, came forward to her, and put out his hand. Maggie, too, colored with surprise, which soon gave way to pleasure. She put out her hand and looked down at the deformed figure before her with frank eyes, filled for the moment with nothing but the memory of her child's feelings, a memory that was always strong in her. She was the first to speak. "You startled me," she said, smiling faintly. "I never meet anyone here. How came you to be walking here? Did you come to meet me?" It was impossible not to perceive that Maggie felt herself a child again. "Yes, I did," said Philip, still embarrassed. "I wished to see you very much. I watched a long while yesterday on the bank near your house to see if you would come out, but you never came. Then I watched again today, and when I saw the way you took, I kept you in sight, and came down the bank, behind there. I hope you will not be displeased with me." "No," said Maggie, with simple seriousness, walking on as if she meant Philip to accompany her. "I'm very glad you came, for I wished very much to have an opportunity of speaking to you. I've never forgotten how good you were long ago to Tom, and me too, but I was not sure that you would remember us so well. Tom and I have had a great deal of trouble since then, and I think that makes one think more of what happened before the trouble came. I can't believe that you have thought of me so much as I have thought of you," said Philip, timidly. "Do you know, when I was away, I made a picture of you as you looked that morning in the study when you said you would not forget me." Philip drew a large miniature case from his pocket and opened it. Maggie saw her old self leaning on a table, with her black locks hanging down behind her ears, looking into space, with strange, dreamy eyes. It was a watercolor sketch of real Merritt as a portrait. "Oh dear," said Maggie, smiling, and flushed with pleasure, "what a queer little girl I was. I remember myself with my hair in that way, in that pink frock. I really was like a gypsy. I dare say I am now," she added, after a little pause. "Am I like what you expected me to be?" The words might have been those of a coquette, but the full, bright glance Maggie turned on Philip was not that of a coquette. She really did hope he liked her face as it was now, but it was simply the rising again of her innate delight in admiration and love. Philip met her eyes and looked at her in silence for a long moment, before he said quietly, "No, Maggie." The light died out a little from Maggie's face, and there was a slight trembling of the lip. Her eyelids fell lower, but she did not turn away her head, and Philip continued to look at her. Then he said slowly, "You are very much more beautiful than I thought you would be." "Am I?" said Maggie, the pleasure returning in a deeper flush. She turned her face away from him, and took some steps, looking straight before her in silence, as if she were adjusting her consciousness to this new idea. Girls are so accustomed to think of dress as the main ground of vanity, that, in abstaining from the looking glass, Maggie had thought more of abandoning all care for adornment than of renouncing the contemplation of her face. Comparing herself with elegant, wealthy young ladies, it had not occurred to her that she could produce any effect with her person. Philip seemed to like the silence well. He walked by her side, watching her face, as if that sight left no room for any other wish. They had passed from among the fir trees, and had now come to a green hollow almost surrounded by an amphitheater of the pale pink dog roses. But as the light about them had brightened, Maggie's face had lost its glow. She stood still when they were in the hollows, and looking at Philip again, she said in a serious, sad voice, "I wish we could have been friends, I mean, if it would have been good and right for us. But that is the trial I have to bear in everything. I may not keep anything I used to love when I was little. The old books went, and Tom is different, and my father. It is like death. I must part with everything I cared for when I was a child. And I must part with you. We must never take any notice of each other again. That was what I wanted to speak to you for. I wanted to let you know that Tom and I can't do as we like about such things, and that if I behave as if I had forgotten all about you, it is not out of envy or pride or any bad feeling." Maggie spoke with more and more sorrowful gentleness as she went on, and her eyes began to fill with tears. The deepening expression of pain on Philip's face gave him a stronger resemblance to his boyish self, and made the deformity appeal more strongly to her pity. "I know, I see all that you mean," he said, in a voice that had become feebler from discouragement. "I know what there is to keep us apart on both sides. But it is not right, Maggie, don't you be angry with me, I am so used to call you Maggie in my thoughts, it is not right to sacrifice everything to other people's unreasonable feelings. I would give up a great deal for my father, but I would not give up a friendship, or an attachment of any sort, in obedience to any wish of his, that I didn't recognize as right." "I don't know," said Maggie, musingly. "Oh, often, when I have been angry and discontented, it has seemed to me that I was not bound to give up anything, and I have gone on thinking till it has seemed to me that I could think away all my duty. But no good has ever come of that. It was an evil state of mind. I'm quite sure that whatever I might do, I should wish in the end that I had gone without anything for myself, rather than have made my father's life harder to him. But would it make his life harder if we were to see each other sometimes?" said Philip. He was going to say something else, but checked himself. "Oh, I'm sure he wouldn't like it. Don't ask me why, or anything about it," said Maggie, in a distressed tone. "My father feels so strongly about some things. He is not at all happy. No more am I, said Philip, impetuously. I am not happy. Why? Said Maggie, gently. At least I ought not to ask, but I'm very, very sorry. Philip turned to walk on, as if he had not patience to stand still any longer, and they went out of the hollow, winding amongst the trees and bushes in silence. After that last word of Philip's, Maggie could not bear to insist immediately on their parting. I've been a great deal happier, she said at last, timidly, since I have given up thinking about what is easy and pleasant, and being discontented, because I couldn't have my own will. Our life is determined for us, and it makes the mind very free when we give up wishing, and only think of bearing what is laid upon us, and doing what is given us to do. But I can't give up wishing, said Philip, impatiently. It seems to me, we can never give up longing and wishing while we are thoroughly alive. There are certain things we feel to be beautiful and good, and we must hunger after them. How can we ever be satisfied without them until our feelings are deadened? I delight in fine pictures. I long to be able to paint such. I strive and strive, and can't produce what I want. That is pain to me, and always will be pain, until my faculties lose their keenness, like age dies. Then there are many other things I long for. Here Philip hesitated a little, and then said, things that other men have, and that will always be denied me. My life will have nothing great or beautiful in it. I would rather not have lived. Oh, Philip, said Maggie, I wish you didn't feel so. But her heart began to beat with something of Philip's discontent. Well then, said he, turning quickly round and fixing his gray eyes entreatingly on her face, I should be contented to live, if you would let me see you sometimes. Then, checked by a fear which her face suggested, he looked away again, and said more calmly, I have no friend to whom I can tell everything, no one who cares enough about me. And if I could only see you now and then, and you would let me talk to you a little, and show me that you cared for me, and that we may always be friends in heart, and help each other, then I might come to be glad of life. But how can I see you, Philip? Said Maggie, falteringly. Could she really do him good? It would be very hard to say goodbye this day, and not speak to him again. Here was a new interest to vary the days. It was so much easier to renounce the interest before it came. If you would let me see you here sometimes, walk with you here, I would be contented, if it were only once or twice in a month. That could injure no one's happiness, and it would sweeten my life. Besides, Philip went on, with all the inventive astuteness of love at 21, if there is any enmity between those who belong to us, we ought all the more to try and quench it by our friendship. I mean, that by our influence on both sides we might bring about a healing of the wounds that have been made in the past, if I could know everything about them. And I don't believe there is any enmity in my own father's mind. I think he has proved the contrary. Maggie shook her head slowly, and was silent, under conflicting thoughts. It seemed to her inclination, that to see Philip now and then, and keep up the bond of friendship with him, was something not only innocent, but good. Perhaps she might really help him to find contentment as he had found it. The voice that said this made sweet music to Maggie. But athwart it there came an urgent, monotonous warning from another voice which as he had been learning to obey, the warning that such interviews implied secrecy, implied doing something she would dread to be discovered in, something that, if discovered, must cause anger and pain, and that the admission of anything so near doubleness would act as a spiritual blight. Yet the music would swell out again, like chimes borne onward by a recurrent breeze. Persuading. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.